Your family tried to kill me, Elvie thought. You shared your bed every night with a man who wanted me dead. You're welcome, she said. She's a very talented girl. She is, Lucia said. And God knows I tried to talk her out of being a doctor. You were hoping she'd stay? Elvie asked, and her voice was more brittle than she'd intended. Not that, no, Lucia said, laughing. That she's leaving this planet is the only good thing that's happened since we came. It's only that I'm afraid she's doing it because it's what I do. Better that she find her own way. It's a long way to Luna, Fias said. I mean, I had 5 major courses of study before I fell in love with geohydraulics. I was going to be a brewer. Can you imagine that? Elvie and Lucia said yes at precisely the same time. Elvie smiled despite herself. Lucia stood. I should go get Jacek, she said. Is he all right? Elvie asked. It was a reflex, a habit of etiquette. She wished she could take the question back even as the words left her mouth. The doctor's smile was wistful. As well as can be expected, she said. His father is leaving today. Taken prisoner on the Rocinante, Elvie thought, but said nothing. Your money's no good here, Fias said. It's on me. Thank you, Dr. Sarkis. Fias. Call me Fias. Everyone else does. Lucia nodded and walked away. Fias shook his head and stretched, his arm reaching behind Elvie's shoulders. She shifted to the opposite side of the table. What the hell are you doing? She asked. What am I doing? You think that's the question? You know that her husband... I don't know a damn thing, Elvie. Neither do you. I'm rich in interpretation and poor in data sets, just the same as you. You think it's not? I think that building was filled with terrorists and that Murtry killed them and saved us. That's what I think, though. I also think that the more the locals know and love me, the less likely it is that I'll be scalped in the next uprising. And what is civilization if it isn't people talking to each other over a goddamn beer? Fias said, then lolled his head back over his shoulder. Am I right? Fucking A, Amos called back. That sure is whatever you were talking about. That's right, Fias said. You're drunk. I've been doing this for a while, Fias said. I've probably had drinks with a third of the people in this shithole. What I want to know is where the rest of you are while I'm making peace. For a moment, she could see his fear, too. It was in the angle of his jaw, and the way his half-closed eyes cut to the left, avoiding hers. Fias, who could laugh at anything, however tragic, was scared out of his wits. And why wouldn't he be? They were billions of clicks from home, on a planet they didn't understand, and in the middle of a war that had now killed people on both sides. And how odd and obvious that it would be a victory for their side, the nameless, faceless killers identified and killed or imprisoned, that would call up the panic. Fias was waiting. Waiting for the next escalation. The other shoe to drop. He was reaching out for whatever control he could find or hope for or pretend into being. Elvie understood because she felt just the same. Only she hadn't known it until she saw it in someone else. He scowled down at the table. Then slowly his gaze floated up to meet hers. What are you doing here? Sitting with you, apparently, she said. Waiting for the other shoe. Chapter 21. Baja. Baja stood at the edge of the landing area, steel shackles damp with his sweat and chafing his wrists and forearms. Murtry had insisted on restraints until Baja was off-planet, though he had given the key to Amos, and the big man had assured Baja he'd be uncuffed once the Rocinante lifted off. It was one last visible demonstration to the citizens of Illus that Murtry could and would exert his will upon them. Jim Holden was still trying to play the peacemaker, and he'd agreed to the restraints in exchange for Baja being released into his custody without any further threats or considerations. Baja understood why everyone was doing what they were doing. It didn't make it less humiliating. Lucia and Jacek stood with him, waiting for the Rocinante to land. Jacek stood in front of him, back pressed to his father's stomach and Baja's cuffed hands on his shoulders. His wife's hand, gripping his own, rested on his son's shoulder. All three of them touching. He tried to draw strength from it, tried to lock the sensation of having his wife and his son close to hand into his memory. He had the terrible sense that it was the last time he'd ever feel her touch. He felt both relief and sadness that Felcia was already gone. Bad enough that his son, too young really to understand what it all meant, had to see him in chains. He could not have stood his bright, beautiful girl seeing him that way. The other townspeople, men and women who had lived with sharing air and water and sorrow and rage, avoided the spectacle of his departure as if his guilt were an illness they might catch. He'd become a stranger to them. He might almost have preferred to have them condemn him. All I wanted was my freedom. All I wanted was my family with me, and not to lose another child to them. He was amazed and sick at heart that that had been too much to ask of the universe. Amos, his nominal guard, stood a respectful distance away, arms crossed and staring up at the sky, giving the family the space to say goodbye. Holden stood with Murtry and Carol, the triumvirate of power on Illus. They weren't looking at each other. They were there to take the sting off of Murtry exerting his control by pretending they were part of the decision. His life was a pawn in their political games. Nothing more.
"Just a couple more minutes, Chief," Amos said.
A moment later came a high-altitude thunderclap, the Rocinante dropping through the atmosphere faster than sound, descending on them all like the Angel of Judgment. It seemed unreal. "I'm happy having you two here with me right now," he told Lucia. It wasn't even a lie. "Find a way to come back to us," she said. "I don't know what I can do." "Find a way," she repeated, making each word its own sentence. "You do that, Baja. Don't make me grow old on this world alone." Baja felt something thick blocking his throat, and he had trouble breathing around the pain in his stomach.
"If you need to find someone..."
"I did," Lucia said. "I found someone. Now he needs to find a way to come back to me." Baja didn't trust himself to speak, worried that if he opened his mouth it would turn into a sob. He didn't want Murtry to see that. So instead he put his cuffed arms around Lucia and pulled her tight and squeezed until neither of them could breathe. "Come back," she whispered one last time. Anything she might have said after that was drowned out by the roar of the Rocinante landing. A wall of dust blew past, stinging the bare skin on Baja's neck. Lucia pressed her face into his chest, and Jacek clung to his back.
"Time to go," Amos shouted.
Baja let go of Lucia, hugged his boy to his chest one last time, the last time, maybe, and turned away from them both to board his prison. "Welcome aboard, Mr. Merton," a tall, pretty woman said when the inner airlock door opened. She wore a simple jumpsuit of gray and black with the name Nagata stenciled over the breast pocket. Naomi Nagata, the executive officer of the Rocinante. She had long black hair pulled into a ponytail, the same way Felcia had worn hers when she was a young girl. On Naomi, it looked more like a functional choice than an aesthetic one. She didn't appear to be armed, and Baja felt himself relax a degree. He handed her the key to his restraints, and she unlocked them.
Bajia, please, he said as she worked. I'm just a welder. No one has ever called me Mr. Merton.
Welder? Naomi asked. It didn't sound like she was making pleasantries. She took the restraints, rolled them into a ball, and secured them in a locker, shipboard discipline, where any free object became a projectile during maneuvers. Because we always have a repair list. The compartment they stood in looked like a large storage room laid on its side. The lockers ran parallel to the ground rather than vertically, and there was a small hatch on either wall, with what looked like a ladder running across the floor. Naomi tapped on a panel on one wall and said, Strapping in down here. Alex, get us off this dust ball before my knees start leaking. A disembodied voice with a Martian Mariner Valley twang said, Roger that, boss. Up in 30 ticks, so get belted in. Naomi pulled on a strap on the floor and a seat folded out. It was designed so a person would have to lie on the floor on their back to put their butt on the seat. A variety of restraining belts folded out with it. She pointed at another strap in the floor and said, Better get with it. We lift in 30 seconds. Bajia pulled out his own seat and awkwardly lay on the ground to get into the straps. Naomi helped him buckle in. The Martian voice counted down from 5, and the floor lurched as the ship lifted off. There was a disorienting rotation, and the floor became a wall behind him, and he was actually sitting on the cushion he'd pulled out. He became very grateful for the straps holding him in place. Then a giant roared at the bottom of the ship, and an invisible hand crushed Bajia into his chair. Sorry, Naomi said, her voice given a false vibrato by the rumbling of the ship. Alex is an old combat pilot. He only flies at full speed. As always when flying out of a gravity well, Bajia was surprised by how quickly it was over. A few minutes of crushing gravity and the roar of the engines, then with almost no transition at all, he was floating in his straps in silence. All done, Naomi said as she began unbuckling. Might be a few short maneuvering bumps as Alex gets us into the orbit he wants, but those yellow lights on the wall will flash 15 seconds before any burn, so just grab a strap and hang on. Am I a prisoner? Bajia asked. What? I'm just wondering how this works. Am I restricted to my room, or is there a brig or something? Naomi floated for a moment, staring at him, forehead crinkling with what looked like genuine puzzlement. Are you a bad guy? Bad guy? Are you going to try to hurt anyone on this ship? Destroy our property? Steal things? Definitely not, Bajia said. Because the way I heard it, you turned on your friends in order to save our captain's life. For a moment, Bajia felt something like vertigo, and then pride, or the promise of it. And then he remembered the concussion of the heavy shuttle rattling him and Coop's voice. We all remember who mashed that button. He shook his head. Are you a bad guy? Naomi Nagata waited for him to speak. But he didn't have words for the guilt and shame and anger and sorrow. In time, she lifted a fist, the belter's physical idiom for a nod. He lifted his in reply. Make yourself at home. She pointed at the hatch to his right. That's aft. That way is the crew decks and the galley. The galley is open whenever. We've got a cabin set up for you. It's tiny, but private. If you keep going aft and hit the machine shop, you've gone too far. For safety reasons, don't go into the machine shop or engineering. Okay, I promise. Don't promise, just don't go in there. The other way, she pointed at the hatch on his left, takes you up to the ops deck. You can come up there if you want, but don't touch anything unless we tell you to. Okay. I'm headed up there right now. You're welcome to tag along. Okay. Naomi stared at him for a second, an unreadable expression on her face. You're not our first, you know. First? First prisoner transport, Naomi said.
Jim has this thing about fair trials. It means that we've done our share of taking people to court, even when an airlock and mysteriously erased records made a lot more sense. Baja couldn't stop himself from giving the airlock door a nervous look.
Okay.
And, she continued, you're the first one I can remember that he specifically told me to be nice to.
He did?
He owes you one.
I do too, Naomi said,
then gestured at the ladder and the deck hatch in a you-first motion. Baja pulled himself up to the hatch and it whined open. Naomi pulled herself along behind him. So you can get comfortable, but the terrified mousy thing you're doing right now will bug the shit out of me.
Okay.
Still doing it. The deck above the storage and airlock area was a large compartment filled with gimbaled chairs and wall-mounted screens and control panels. A dark-skinned man with thinning black hair and a middle-aged beer belly was strapped into one of the chairs. He turned to face them as they floated into the room.
All good?
He asked Naomi. He was the source of the Mariner Valley voice.
Seems to be, Naomi said, and pushed Baja into the closest chair, then strapped him in.
He allowed it to happen, feeling like an infant being manhandled by his mother. Didn't get any face time with Jim. He wanted this fellow off the ground as fast as possible.
Well, can't say I was looking to stay longer.
I know. Gravity wells, Naomi said with a shudder. I don't know how people live like that.
I was thinking more about the bugs all coming back to life. I got 5 more power spikes since the last time we checked.
I was trying not to think about those.
Should have gotten Holden to name us both, Alex said, and anyone else with sense.
Just keep an eye. If anything gets close, I want them to know about it. Once she'd finished belting him in, Naomi floated over to a different chair and pulled herself into it. She began calling up screens and tapping on them faster than Baja could follow, still talking to the Martian man as she worked. Alex, she said, meet Baja Merton, the welder.
Welder? Alex raised his eyebrows and grinned. We got a pile of shit on the to-do list with Amos vacationing on the surface.
Baja opened his mouth to reply, but Naomi said, Baja, meet Alex Kamal, our pilot, and the solar system's worst vacuum welder.
Hello, Baja said.
Hello back, Alex said, then turned to Naomi. Hey, well, I'm thinking about it. You were right about that shuttle.
Yeah?
Naomi pushed off her chair and floated over to look at the screen next to Alex. He scrolled through what looked like video on fast forward for a few seconds.
See there? Alex said, pausing it. They detach it and park it a few hundred meters from the Israel, then send an engineering team out. They're inside for a couple hours, then back to the Israel. It hasn't moved out of that orbit since.
They're doing all the shuttle runs with the other one, Naomi said, pulling up a video on the second screen and fast-forwarding through it.
I knew it.
Yeah, you're very clever. Want to keep the scopes recording that, or do I aim them at the bugs?
The shuttle, Naomi replied after a few more seconds of moving back and forth through the video. Baja knew he'd been invited to sit with them, and it appeared they were talking about monitoring the RCE ship, which didn't strike him as a personal conversation. But he couldn't help but feel a bit out of place, like an eavesdropper on a private moment. It was the comfortable shorthand the two members of the Rocinante's crew had. They sounded like family discussing household matters. It was unsettling to think they were the only 3 people on the ship. It was too large, too empty. He didn't want to be alone in the silence of an unfamiliar ship, but staying felt wrong too. Baja cleared his throat.
Should I go to my cabin?
Do you want to? Naomi asked without looking at him. There is nothing to do in there. It's not even one of the ones with its own video display. All the good cabins are taken by crew.
You can get access to the ship's library from there, Alex said,
pointing at the screen closest to Baja. If you're bored. I'm scared as shit, Baja said, without knowing ahead of time that he was going to. Alex and Naomi both turned to look at him. The Martian's face was kind. He said,
Yeah, I bet. But nothing bad is going to happen to you here. Until the captain says otherwise, treat this like home. If you want to be alone, we can...
No, Baja shook his head.
No.
But you're talking to each other like I'm not here, so I thought...
He shrugged.
Sorry. We've been together enough years we almost don't need to talk anymore, Naomi said. I think the Israel has weaponized one of its shuttles. We've been monitoring the ship, and the activity around one shuttle was suspicious. I think they turned it into a bomb.
Why would they do that?
Because, Alex answered, that's an unarmed science ship, and they flew into what they seem to see as a war zone. That shuttle could be used to attack another ship like a guided missile, or maybe as a bomb to flatten the colony.
They want to attack you? Baja asked.
Why would they do that? Wasn't the Rosinante and her crew here to solve the conflict?
I doubt it, Naomi said. More likely the Barbapiccola if she tries to break orbit and run.
Yeah, Alex said with a laugh. The Israel takes a swing at us, it'll be the shortest dogfight in history.
First landing. They could flatten the colony? Baja said.
They don't know that. You should warn them. My family is still down there.
Trust me, Naomi said. That won't happen. Now that we know, we'll keep an eye on that shuttle, and if it moves, we can stop it.
Should probably tell the boss, though, Alex said.
Yeah.
Naomi tracked through the video a few more times, then shut it off.
Alex unbuckled his restraint and pushed off toward the ladder.
Or, shit, Exo, I can take care of it right now. I had the Rosie go over the shuttle specs and calculate a railgun shot that'll cut her damn reactor in half.
Naomi stopped him with a shake of her hand.
No. Just once I'd like to find a solution that doesn't involve blowing something up.
Alex shrugged.
Your call.
Naomi floated quietly for a moment, then seemed to come to a decision and hit the comm panel. After a few seconds, Jim Holden's voice said,
Holden here.
Jim, I've got a problem and a solution I need to run past you.
I like that we already have a solution, Holden replied.
Baja could hear the smile in his voice.
Two solutions, Alex called out. I've got a solution, too.
We've been watching the Israel like you asked, Naomi said, and Alex and I agree that the probability is high they've weaponized one of the two light shuttles. They're keeping it powered down and in a matching orbit about 500 meters from the big ship. I think it's a last-ditch weapon to use if the barb tries to run, but that doesn't mean they couldn't use it on the colony, as unlikely as that seems.
You haven't met this Murtry character running RCE security, Holden said,
or it would be pretty damn likely.
What's our best course of action?
We get everyone off the planet, go back home, and spend a few decades doing unmanned exploration before we even think of coming back, Naomi said.
Agreed, Holden said.
And what are we actually going to do?
I figure you'd want us to take care of it. Alex thinks he can gut it with a railgun shot, but that seems like a pretty obvious escalation to me.
Shooting Gauss rounds past the Israel, I mean.
Things are escalating just fine on their own, Holden said. But we'll keep that option on the table for now. What else?
Naomi pulled herself closer to the comm panel and lowered her voice, as though the console were Holden himself and she was about to deliver bad news. I take an EVA pack, fly over to the shuttle, and plant a cutout on the drive. If they run system checks, everything will come back functional. But if they try to move the shuttle, I can kill it remotely. No explosions, just a dead shuttle.
That seems risky, Holden said.
Riskier than flinging railgun shots through its reactor?
Not really, no.
Riskier than leaving it out there and armed?
Oh, hell no.
Okay, Naomi, this is your call.
One way or the other, I want that threat off the board. We have enough shit to worry about down here.
Naomi smiled at the comm panel. One dead shuttle coming up.
She shut off the connection with a sigh.
Baja looked from one to the other of them, scowling.
Why?
Why what? Naomi asked lightly.
Why would you act directly against RCE?
Aren't you supposed to be mediators? Neutral?
Why take any action at all when you can stay out of it?
Her smile had depth and complexity. Baja had the feeling she'd heard a more profound question than the one he'd meant to ask.
Choosing to stand by while people kill each other is also an action, she said. We don't do that here.
Chapter 22. Havelock. Havelock's system filtered the news feeds from Seoul, and it was still damn weird thinking from Seoul, for four topics. New Terra, James Holden, contract security, and European League football. Strapped in his office crash couch, he tapped through the feed summaries. Changes to compensation schedule regulations tipped the balance toward Earth-based contract security. Star Helix to protest. He deleted it. Earthman's Burden. 50 famous Earthers who switched sides for the OPA. Holden was number 41. Havelock deleted it. Los Blancos defeat Bayern. 1-0. Havelock raised his eyebrows and put the highlights reel in his viewing queue. Increased violence on New Terra. UN and OPA react. Mars positioning with OPA. Havelock felt his belly go tight. The feed came from an intelligence analysis service with contacts in the governments of all three major powers. He opened it. This is Nasser Maxwell with Forecast Analytics, and this proprietary feed is intended solely for use by the subscribers and partners of Forecast Analytics. Any other distribution is in violation of MCR and UN intellectual property statutes and is subject to prosecution. Intelligence reports from the UN indicate that the violence on New Terra has escalated. The security forces of Royal Charter Energy discovered a new potential attack, and in thwarting it, killed between 7 and 16 local insurgents. Reaction from the OPA to the attack itself has been muted, but the RCE and United Nations forces will be announcing this afternoon that a relief mission will be launched for New Terra. Initial reports suggest this will be a joint task force, with both corporate assets and United Nations military escort. Representatives of the OPA have not responded to this plan, but are on record as being willing to use military force to control traffic through Medina Station. Given the tactical constraints of the ring gates, Forecast Analytics projects the possibility of a modest OPA military force being able to effectively blockade the UN and RCE efforts. Sources close to the Martian Congress, speaking with Forecast Analytics under condition of anonymity, have suggested that the Martian government would support the OPA's action. Analysis suggests that this is not evidence for a long-term amity between the OPA and Mars, but a tactical alliance intended to forestall the UN and Earth-Luna corporate structures from establishing a greater foothold in these new worlds. Given the time it will take a UN and RCE group to be assembled and make the journey to Medina Station, we predict that the situation on New Terra will be evolving without immediate physical involvement from in-system players for the foreseeable future, and the greater question of how traffic through the gates will be regulated will be a source of high-level tension and probable military action in the coming months and years. Havelock scratched his ear. Prior experience told him that Forecast Analytics was usually about a day ahead of the mainline non-proprietary feeds, which would mean that in about 30 hours, they'd be getting flooded with news and opinion pieces about themselves from people who'd never been farther than the Jovian system. Even if it only changed the stories that the people downstairs were telling about themselves, it could make things even worse. If the squatters knew there were more RCE ships coming, even if they weren't going to be here for years, maybe they'd get even more desperate. Or maybe Mars getting in bed with the OPA would make them think they had support back home.
Either way, nothing good could come of it. Havelock wished there was a way to shut down the communication to the ring, just as a way to keep the dramatics of national politics contained. Things were screwed up enough without getting the professional class screw-ups at the UN involved. More than they already were, anyway. At least they hadn't picked up on the UN/OPA mediator deciding the planet was full of boojums and was telling everyone to run away and hide under their blankets. Or, on second thought, maybe it would have been better if they had. It would be a distraction, anyway. His hand terminal squawked, and he accepted the connection. "I think we're about ready," Chief Engineer Kunin said. "I'll be right there," Havelock replied, releasing the couch straps. He pushed off toward the door and hauled himself hand over hand toward the airlock. He slid into the storage deck, where his little militia was waiting. His brain arbitrarily deciding that the bank of lockers was down, the airlock door up. Human brains needed an answer, even if they had to make up something they knew was bullshit. A dozen people floated in the space. Havelock started talking to them as he lifted his own vacuum suit out of the locker at his feet. "Good to see you today, team. So we're going to do a practice breaching. It's going to be a lot like last time, except this time we're going to have a squad that's trying to stop you." One of the men at the back shook a paint gun and hooted. The others around him laughed. Havelock pulled on the vacuum suit and started working the seals. He left the helmet off for the moment so that he could speak through the free air. "Do we have teams set up?" "I'm taking Alpha and Beta," Kunin said. "Figured you could lead the Gamma on attack." "That works," Havelock said. He shifted his paintball gun from side to side, getting a feel for its mass. "You have the emergency airlock?" "Here," one of the Beta teams said, twisting to show his backpack. The bright yellow box held a bubble of adhesive-backed polymer, bound to a second sheet that was fitted with a seal and an inflating tank the size of Havelock's thumb. Laid out properly on the hull of a ship, it would look like a hemispherical blister, and contain up to 2 atmospheres of pressure indefinitely, or 8 for a full 10th of a second. Havelock wasn't actually going to let the engineers cut through the hull of the Israel, but he was going to make sure they could get everything ready up to the moment when they'd fire up the torch welders. "All right," he said. "Now, before we get out there, remember, we're on the outside of a ship, and the shuttle is on the planet. The chances of your drifting to where we can't get you back are non-zero." The little bit of joking and whispering stopped. Havelock looked through the room, making eye contact with several of them as if his gaze were enough to make them safe. "All these suits have mag boots," he said. "They only work for a few centimeters, so they'll keep you against the ship, but they won't pull you back to it. For that, you have the grapnel lines. You've all trained with those?" A murmur of general assent answered him. "All right, if you're drifting, the grapnel line will adhere to any metal surface on the hull. They've got their own propellant, so there won't be any kick. Do not, under any circumstances, pass through or stop in any of the areas marked in red. Those are maneuvering thruster outlets. And while we aren't planning to make any adjustments, don't assume it. We're not doing this to lose anyone else. If you get out there and you start feeling too hot or like there's something wrong with your air feed, you're probably having a panic attack. Just let me or the chief know and we'll pause the exercise and get you inside. If you start feeling wonderful and powerful and like you've seen the face of God, you're having a euphoric attack. And those are more dangerous than the panic. You aren't going to want to tell us about those, but you have to. All right?" A ragged chorus of, "Sir, yes, sir," echoed through the room. Havelock tried to think of what else he should say. He didn't want to insult their intelligence, but he didn't want anything to go wrong, either. In the end, he shrugged, fastened the helmet, and gave the order through the exercise frequency. "Alpha and Beta teams, into the lock. You've got 30 minutes. There were 3 exercise-specific settings on the suit radio. One was open to all the people going out. One was just for Havelock's team, and the last was between him and Kunin. The mom-and-pop channel, the chief engineer called it. Havelock opened all the channels, but all he could hear was the banter of his own group. The chief and his men weren't transmitting. After 10 minutes, Havelock switched to the mom-and-pop channel.
Okay, he said, we're coming out.
There was a crackle as the chief switched.
That wasn't 30 minutes.
I know, Havelock said, and the chief chuckled.
Okay, thank you for the heads up. I won't give it away.
Astronomy had never been a particular interest of Havelock's, and living in a ship or station, he'd seen actual stars less often than he did in his childhood on Earth. The starscape around New Terra was beautiful, familiar and unfamiliar at the same time. The few constellations he knew, Orion, Ursa Major, weren't there, but he still looked for them. The bright smear of the galactic disk was still part of the sky, and the local sun could pass for Sol. More or less, anyway. New Terra's ring of tiny moons caught the light, their low albedo making them hardly more than stars behind them. The Edward Israel was moving at something like 8,000 kilometers a minute. That this stillness masked a velocity that was orders of magnitude faster than a rifle shot was intellectual knowledge. What he felt was motionless. He stood on the skin of the ship, rooted by his mag boots, shifting gently like seaweed on the ocean floor. To his right, New Terra's Terminator seemed to inch across its vast ocean. To his left, the shuttle stood half a kilometer out, looking small and forlorn against the vast night. His strike force stood around him, craning their necks, in awe of the massive emptiness all around. He was almost sorry to pull his attention back to the small, vaguely intimate necessities of violence. He checked to be sure he was speaking on the channel exclusive to his group.
All right. Their target area for setting up the emergency lock is aft of the main storage area. We're going around clockwise. In 10 minutes, we'll be moving into Eclipse. If we come up from between the primary maneuvering thrusters and hangar bay, we should have the sun behind us. So let's get moving. The small chorus of excited yes sirs told him they liked the idea.
Coming out of the sun, raining death on the enemy. It was a pretty enough plan. The only things that kept it from happening were their unfamiliarity with the mag boots and the fact that Kunin had placed the emergency airlock 100 meters farther away than Havelock had expected. The bright moment passed, and the sun shifted behind New Terra, where it would stay for almost 20 minutes.
Okay, Havelock said. Plan B. Everyone turn off your helmet lights.
What about the indicators on our external batteries, sir?
We're going to have to hope they're dim enough that—
One of the engineers to his left raised the paint gun and turned it on himself. The muzzle flash was like a spark.
What the hell are you doing? Havelock demanded.
I figured if I got some paint on the indicator light, I could—
The man began, but it was too late. Kernan's men had seen the muzzle flash. Havelock tried to get his forces to hunker down close to the skin of the ship and fire across the ship's shallow horizon, but they kept rising up to see if they'd struck anything. In less than a minute, the last of his men reported an enemy hit, and Havelock called the exercise to a halt. The massive, dark bulk of the planet was almost above them now. The sunlight a soft ring where the atmosphere scattered it. The two groups gathered. The airlock was only half attached, and three of his team's paintballs had smeared it. Two of the chief engineer's boarding party had been hit. The rest were elated. Havelock set his team and the wounded of the opposition to clean up, and the disgraced soldiers started repacking the airlock.
Nice work, Havelock said on the mom-and-pop channel.
Kunin grunted. His arms were crossed awkwardly over his chest, the bulk of the suit defying the pose. Havelock frowned.
not that anyone could see him.
Something the matter, Chief?
You know, the chief engineer said, I don't mind that the Israel has her own engineering crew. I understand that we've got separate mandates. But we're working with the same equipment and supplies, and as a courtesy, I'd like to be kept in the loop when the ship crew are sending out a team.
Okay, Havelock said. I can talk to them when we get in.
Is it something that's been happening often?
It's happening right now, the chief said, pointing out into the darkness.
It took Havelock a moment to see it, a flicker where no flicker should be. The weaponized shuttle brightened and dimmed. A welding torch, half a click away in the darkness. Panic felt strange in Nalji, the blood flowing away from his hands and feet.
Do you have enhanced magnification on your helmet? Havelock asked.
Yeah, the chief said.
Could you take a look at who's out there?
The chief engineer bent back. The surface of his helmet glittered for a moment, the HUD taking over.
Red EVA suit. Got a decent-sized pack on it, too. Long-distance travel. And a welding kit.
Havelock said something obscene, then switched to the all-group channel. Everyone stop, we have a problem. There's someone at the shuttle over there, and he isn't one of ours. For a moment, no one spoke. Then one of the militiamen, his voice calm and matter-of-fact, said, Let's go kick his ass. It was exactly not what Havelock wanted to do. If the enemy had a rifle, he could pick half the team off before they got close. Even then, they had paint guns. But the alternative was to let whoever they were do whatever they were doing to the only ace up the Israel sleeve.
Okay, Havelock said. Here's the plan. Everyone sync up with the ship's computer. We're going to let the Israel calculate our burns. Turn off the mag boots.
He plucked out his hand terminal, fed in the emergency security override, and coded in his request. Their vacuum suits had more than enough propellant to get them all to the shuttle and back again, provided nobody missed or tried to do something clever. Above them, the penumbra around New Terra grew lopsided, the sun preparing to reemerge. Another tiny dawn. The computer announced the burns were ready.
Okay, Havelock said, these are the bad guys. We don't know how many there are, we don't know how they're armed. So we're going to try to scare them off. Everyone get your gun at the ready. Look threatening, and don't fire. If they figure out your guns aren't real, we may be in for a bad time.
Sir, one of the men said,
you remember we're covered with target paint, right?
Before Havelock could answer, the thrusters started, pushing compressed gas out behind them like a fog and smoke. All their suits rose together into the night, or else fell. The acceleration pushed the blood into Havelock's legs, and the suit squeezed, pressing it back. It wasn't even a full G. It was hardly a third. But it felt like something much, much faster, much more dangerous. Now that he knew to look for it, the welding flicker was obvious. It didn't stop. The main burn cut out. The suits rotated, starting the braking burn. The perfect synchrony meant the Israel was still coordinating them. This time, the intruder saw them. The welding torch died. Havelock looked down between his feet, his paint gun centered between his toes, waiting for the bullets to start streaming out and praying that they wouldn't. They didn't.
It's working, one of the men shouted. Motherfucker's running away.
And there it was. A red EVA suit on the skin of the shuttle. It struggled with something, looked up toward Havelock and his militia descending upon him, and turned back. Whoever it was, there was only one of them. The braking thrust stuttered. They were almost at the shuttle now, 50 meters, 40, 30. Havelock opened a standard general response channel.
Attention, unidentified welder. You will stand down.
The red suit stood, the EVA suit firing off. The person lifted at a 90-degree angle,
not going directly away from them, but diving down toward the planetary surface and whatever lower orbit would mean a safe rendezvous. Havelock felt the relief flooding him. They weren't shooting. His HUD promised him that the shuttle's basic functions were unchanged. It hadn't been set to detonate, and the militia boys weren't in charge of their own burns, so they wouldn't be taking off after the intruder. He had underestimated them. The first dark thread rose out toward the intruder and missed. But once the whole team had seen the grapnel fire, the idea was out there. A half dozen grapnels fired, their propellant flaring blue and orange as they flew like tiny missiles toward the fleeing welder. Then one made contact. The enemy and the man who'd fired the grapnel both jerked, and the engineer's suit started an emergency burn trying to compensate. With the enemy encumbered and slowed, two more grapnels connected. Soon, five of his people had lines attached to the saboteur, their collected thrusters holding the red suit's EVA pack in check. Havelock took control of his suit back from the Israel and dropped down toward the planet and the prisoner. The red suit was twisting now, trying to bring its welding torch to bear on the lines. Havelock raised his gun, and the enemy paused. He was close enough now that he could see the face behind the helmet. A belter woman, dark-skinned with wavy dark hair clinging to her sweaty forehead. Her expression was pure chagrin. He opened the general channel again. "Hi," he said. "Don't panic. My name's Havelock. I'm acting security chief of the Edward Israel, and you have to come with me now."
Interlude. The Investigator. It reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out. 113 times a second it reaches out, and the things it finds are not the signal that would let it end, but they are tools, and it explores them without knowing it is exploring them. Like water finding its mindless way through a bed of pebbles, it reaches out. What it can move, it moves. What it can open, it opens. What it can close, it closes. A vast network, ancient and dead, begins to appear, and it reaches into it. The parts of it that can think struggle to make sense of it. Parts of it dream of a mummified body, its dry heart pumping dust through petrified veins. Not everything responds, but it reaches out, presses, moves, and some things move back. Old artifacts awaken, or don't. None of them are what it seeks. None ever will be. It experiments without awareness of experimenting, and a landscape begins to form. It is not a physical landscape, but a logical one. This connects to this connects to this. It builds a model and adds it to the model it already has, and does not know it has done so. It reaches out. 113 times a second it reaches out. Something that worked once stops working. It reaches out, and what answered before answers less now. Something burns or fails or tries to rise up and breaks. Part of the map goes dark, dies, and it reaches out to the silent dead. Part of it feels frustration, but it is not aware of that part, and it reaches out. Part of it wants to scream, wants to die, wants to vomit through a mouth it imagines has been transformed into something else for years now. It does not experience these things, though parts of it do. It reaches out, and it pulls back. It is unaware of pulling back. But one time out of every 17 million attempts, it touches something and will not touch it again. It is not aware of pulling back, because it is not aware of anything but the failures accrue. A blank place forms, an emptiness, a void. A void. Jesus, an old woman thinks, now with the puns. The map is not physical, but it has shape. It is a model of part of the universe. It becomes more detailed, more concrete. Some things come alive and then die. Some do not answer ever. Some become tools, and it uses the tools to reach out, except not there. The emptiness gains definition, too. With every failed connection, with every pulling back, its liminal borders become better defined. It struggles to make sense of the shape of the nothing that defines it. The structures of the minds that never died within it struggle with it. It is a cyst. It is a negative space. A taboo. It is a question that must not be asked. It is not aware that it thinks these things. It is not aware that the space exists, that when it reaches into that place, it dies. It does not need to be aware of the problem. It has a tool for this, a thing that finds what is missing, a tool for asking questions that shouldn't be asked, for going too far. The investigator considers the cyst, the shadow, the space where nothing is. That right there? The investigator thinks. Yeah, where I come from. We'd call that a clue. Chapter 23. Holden. Come on, Holden said to the empty desert and the man who wasn't there. You show up every time I don't want you around, but I get something I want to talk to you about, and nothing. The thing that had been Miller didn't answer. Holden sighed, hoped, and waited. Illis had lost some of its strangeness. The moonless sky still felt too dark, but no darker than a new moon on Earth. His nose had become accustomed to the planet's strange scents. Now it just smelled like night and the aftermath of rain. His growing familiarity was both comforting and sad. Humans would go out to the thousand worlds of the Gate Network. They would settle down in little towns like First Landing, then spread out and build farms and cities and factories, because that's what humans did. And in a few centuries, most of those worlds would be very similar to Earth. The frontier would give way to the civilizations that followed it, remaking it in the image of their original home. Holden had grown up in the Montana district of North America, a region filled with nostalgia for lost frontiers. It had held out against urban creep longer than most places in the former United States. The people there clung to their farms and ranches, even when those things stopped making economic sense. And because of that, Holden couldn't help but feel the allure of the untamed place. The romantic notion of sights no one else had seen, ground no one else had walked. This new frontier would last throughout Holden's lifetime. Conquering and taming 1,000-plus planets was the work of generations, no matter how much of a head start the protomolecules' masters had given them. But in his heart, Holden knew that conquered and tamed they would be. And then, there would be 1,000 Earths, with steel and glass cities covering them. Holden felt a shadow of that distant future's loss of mystery, as though it were his own. In the moonless black sky, a star moved too quickly. One of the ships, the Israel or the Barbapiccola. The Rocinante was too small and too black to reflect light. Did the people up there think about how momentous what they were all doing was? Holden worried that they didn't. That the strangeness had already become normal, like the night sense of Illis. That all they saw now was the conflict to be won and the treasure to be harvested. With a sigh, Holden turned back toward the town and started walking. Amos would be wondering where he was. Carol, the town administrator, had asked for an after-dinner meeting, so he needed to track her down, too. A fat, dog-shaped thing with a bullfrog's head walked in front of him and made a sound like boots crunching on gravel. Mimic lizards, the locals called them. They were sort of scaled, like a lizard. But to Holden, the limbs looked all wrong. Holden took out his hand terminal and used it to shine a faint light on the creature. It blinked up at him and made the gravel noise again.
"You'd be a good pet if you didn't vomit your stomach up periodically," Holden said, crouching down to get a better look at the creature.
It croaked back at him. Nothing like the words he'd used, but a surprisingly good imitation of his voice and tones. He wondered if the animals could be taught to speak words like a parrot. The terminal in his hand buzzed. The lizard skittered away, buzzing back at him over his shoulder.
"Holden here."
"Yeah, Cap," Alex said. "I got some bad news."
"Bad like the zero-G toilet on the Rosie is out of order, or bad like I should be looking at the sky for incoming missile trails?"
"Well," Alex started, and then took a long breath.
Holden looked up at the sky. Just stars.
"You've scared me now, spit it out."
"Naomi,"
Alex started, and Holden felt his heart drop.
"She was out installing the remote cutout on the shuttle, and they were doing some kind of group exercise on the outside of the Israel, and they spotted her. Just dumb luck, really."
"What happened? Is she okay?"
"Please be okay."
"They got her, Cap," Alex said.
Holden felt his chest go empty.
"Got her, like, shot her?"
"Oh, no, captured. She's not hurt. The security guy on the Israel called to make sure I knew she was unharmed. But they're calling it sabotage, and they locked her up."
"Fuck," Holden said, able to breathe again.
He knew who'd have authorized that. Murtry. And now that the RCE security chief had a big bargaining chip, he'd go all in.
"Does anyone else know?"
"Well, Amos called up looking for her a minute ago."
Holden didn't hear the rest of what Alex said because he was already running toward town. The longer he ran without hearing gunfire, the more hopeful he became that Amos had realized the sensitivity of the situation, had decided to wait and consult with his captain before taking any action. He hoped Amos wasn't already on the radio with the Israel and a pistol held to Murtry's head demanding Naomi's safe return. He was half right. When he burst into Murtry's security office, he found the RCE security chief pressed to one wall with Amos's left hand around his throat and a pistol against his forehead. At least no one had called the Israel with demands, likely because Amos didn't have a free hand to dial. In addition to Murtry and Amos, four RCE security personnel stood around the room with drawn sidearms pointed at Amos's back. One of them, a raven-haired woman named Wei, said, "Drop the gun or we'll shoot."
"Okay," Amos said with a shrug. "Blast away, sweetie. I guarantee I take this piece of shit with me. I'm good. You good?"
He leaned closer to Murtry, punctuating the question with a jab of the pistol against his forehead. A little trickle of blood had started to run down Murtry's face from the force of the barrel pressed against it. Murtry smiled.
"Keep barking, dog. We both know there's no bite coming. You shoot me, she's dead."
"You won't know," Amos said.
"Don't, Amos," Holden ordered.
"Oh, do,"
Murtry said, the words almost a whisper. Holden held his breath, sure the next thing they heard would be a gunshot. Amos surprised him by not firing. Instead, he leaned in even farther until his nose was touching Murtry's and said,
"I'm going to kill you."
"When?"
Murtry replied.
"That is exactly the question that should stay on your mind,"
Amos said, and let the man go. Holden started breathing again with a gasp.
"I've got this, Amos."
The big mechanic holstered his gun to Holden's relief, but made no move to leave.
"Seriously, I've got it. I need you to go back to the rooms and get on the line with Alex. Get me a full report. I'll be back there in a minute."
For a moment, Holden thought Amos would argue with him. The mechanic stared back, face flushed with rage, his jaw clenched hard enough to crack his teeth.
"Okay,"
he finally said.
and then left.